Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, joined as always by Anne Thompson. And Anne, we certainly have plenty to discuss with the festivals and awards season. Things have been moving along with Toronto, and there's New York right around the corner. But before we get into all that, it is sort of nice that the news cycle continues to give us other things to talk about, that there is a world beyond this bubble of the fall festivals. And this past week, we got this fascinating update with Christopher Nolan. So we talked about this a bit earlier, how unhappy he was with the HBO Max situation of all these Warner Brothers films getting day and date releases, which he was spared from with Tenet, obviously. Otherwise, this would have been much uglier in certain ways. But in any case, he's done with Warner Brothers. They're done with him also, is the thing.
I mean, people forget that he was the 500-pound gorilla on that lot, and that he got his way. He could do whatever he wanted. Yeah. He talked them into doing that early release of Tenet before they were ready to do it, before their numbers told them it was time. And there was a report this week that they lost like $50 million on this deal.
Yeah, how much longer?
A movie that should have made them a lot, you know?
Well, also,
so he pushed his weight around.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it wasn't his best movie either. It wasn't
and directors like him, yeah. Right. Alpha male directors like him, A-list directors like him, are not used to failing, are not used to having a disappointment, and they want someone to blame. At any rate, he went and shopped around, and everybody came calling, and he ended up picking Universal.
Which makes sense. I mean, you laid this out, and I think in anticipation of this happening, a lot of people who were looking at the tea leaves assumed that this would be the most natural endpoint. I mean, obviously, I made that very like pie in the sky case that Netflix would actually be a really supportive home for a guy like this. They can, you know, basically do a marketing spend to give him his big IMAX situation for this, you know, Oppenheimer nuclear bomb project, which is the end result is that he needs a theatrical thing. But Universal of the kind of old studios is really the only one right now that seems like it could give him some semblance of what he had before.
I think Sony made a big pitch for it because, of course, they came through for Tarantino on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and did very well with that. But that was actually one of their most successful recent movies. And they couldn't lay claim to the kind of box office track record that Universal had with something like F9, which was the highest grossing studio movie during this whole last period of time in 2021. And it's really a testament. It reveals that Universal is sort of the last big studio standing in a way, in the theatrical universe, in the sense that Warner's is so invested in HBO Max and blew Nolan out the door, in effect, without sharing any upfront. He wants to be he's a control freak. He wants to know what's going on. He wants people to check in with him. And he doesn't sort of cede ground to the studio as being in charge, even if they're giving him the money to make his movies. So Universal stepped up. I'm sure they all did, but he went with the strongest play. Disney is totally invested in streaming. Paramount just lost, you know, Jim Giannopoulos just left, the legacy executive there. And you know, MGM UA, which I think Mike DeLuca probably could have, you know, persuaded him to come there, but he was on his way to a merger with Amazon. Even though they're saying that they're sticking to a theatrical plan, it's still in flux, leaving Universal at the top of the heap.
But it raises some really fascinating questions because I think, so correct me, help me with the details.
Also, Donna Langley wooed him.
Right, for a long time. We should talk about that. They were fellow Brits, if you think about it. Yeah, no, there are probably a few factors there, but we should also look at, so what is the exact rule that Universal has? If you make, what is it, $50 million on your opening weekend, you get a longer theatrical
Yeah, but it's the difference
runway.
Between 3 weekends and 5 weekends.
So one way
so
or
that
another.
Is out the door in this case.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure that Universal was willing to step up to 100 days, but according to trade reports, that was the deal, that he had to give them 100 days.
And when are we seeing this movie? What kind of a world is it going to be coming out?
So it starts shooting in 2022. That's the other question,
what
right?
kind of a world will it come out to?
I know. Where will we be 2 years from now?
It's a real open. I mean, hopefully we'll be somewhere where there is still a reason for this to be worthwhile.
I wonder what the deal language was. That's what I'd love to see how they wrote it out, because they had to give themselves some kind of exit clause. Like if he opened at 45,
yeah,
does the 100 days go out the window?
Yeah.
That's my question.
He would not be happy about that, losing 50%.
But this isn't necessarily a commercial movie. Or how many theaters are going to be around in 2024?
Well, that's
right?
what I would say. I was thinking it's like, at least with Netflix, you have a situation where they look at theatrical events as like a marketing spend. Part of their core business model.
It's part of their branding.
They can do some wild IMAX stuff and let the movie have that life. It's just that for him, it's probably become anathema because it's not their business. Because it's almost like a religion for him, which I respect, but I
which
also find
part
it,
of,
you know, limiting.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's how he got into trouble with Tenet. It was like he set himself up as the savior of theatrical, which was such hubris, really, you know?
Yeah, I mean, who actually
I'm a big fan of Christopher Nolan as a filmmaker, don't get me wrong. I think he's brilliant.
Yeah.
But I think, but here's the thing.
Sometimes.
He flexed his muscles, right? He flexed his muscles and the studios came calling. He got what he wanted.
100%. And I think this raises the other thing we should look at, which is, so official reports about this are that, like Tarantino, the executives had to go to his house, read the script, and then do the pitch, which is almost, it's like an acting exercise or something. I would love to see this, or like a business school kind of experiment, you know, like you have X number of hours to basically look at this thing, understand what it is, decide that it's good enough business for you, and then like make a compelling case to invest in it for like 2+ years.
So the deal itself was the model of what he had at Warner's. That's that part of it was just meet my Warner's deal is what he demanded. The full control, 100% final cut, you know, the marketing spend, the budget he wanted. It was all 100, 100, 100 according to the reports, right? You know, 100 million right. budget, 100 million marketing spend, 100 million 100 days in the theaters. But the part that was not calculable would be his trust in the person behind the desk there to come through for him. And in that case, that person was Donna Langley.
Yeah. And it makes you wonder, I mean, when you read this script, I mean, you know, he did really well with Dunkirk. It was nice to see him find a different kind of register for his style to do, you know, what felt like a more classical war movie, but still had his own sort of imprint on it.
Played around with time and,
now he's
and
going
all
back.
That stuff.
Yeah. So we're curious to see what
As
it is
usual.
About this particular movie, which is another, you know, wartime period piece that makes it $100 million movie. I mean, presumably we're going to see
a mushroom cloud would be my guess.
Yeah, exactly. So, it is a fascinating sort of question. And the other part of it I think is really worth looking at is just how rare this is. I mean, is there any other living filmmaker anywhere who could possibly get studios to say, sure, whatever you want, $100 million here, $100 million there?
This is one movie. Right. So it's not like it's a long-term thing. One person is Steven Spielberg.
Maybe. Would that still be the case?
I think
now?
Ridley Scott.
Maybe. I mean,
these are the A-listers. These are the top of the line. You know,
I mean, there's certainly
Peter Jackson with the right project, although he hasn't.
Well, it's been a couple years.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I look
Cameron,
at people.
Jim Cameron, look at the paycheck that's been. Wallet that's been opened for Jim Cameron.
But Jim Cameron
over
also.
How many years has it been since Avatar hasn't happened?
But I was going to say with Jim Cameron, he doesn't need anyone. He can just open his own wallet also.
Nobody does that, though.
Yeah. So it's just, I mean, there are certain filmmakers who I think, you know, you have like the PTAs out there who like maybe they can get any actor they want, or you have
Tarantino.
They have
Tarantino. To keep it down to a certain level. Now, Tarantino got the budget, remember. He did. So,
yeah, he did on that
so
case.
He's,
but it was also because he was leaving a long-time deal, the same situation as Nolan. So very
and
unique.
And he shopped it around. It was a bidding war. And he had, but he held on to some copyright there. So that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. But I think it's, I mean, there is
he another
aspect.
He wants to own all his movies.
There is another aspect here, which is, you know, we are ultimately only talking about white men here. And within
Indeed.
The larger context of trying to diversify the system, I'd be curious to see, you know, is there even a pathway for a non-white male director to get to the point where you have, you know, studios saying, yes, please, we want you and we'll give you everything you want in order to do this? Or are those deals just not really going to happen anymore because in general, they're just not good business to have? I mean, mega deals in general seem to be.
You could argue that the kind of filmmaker Nolan and Spielberg and Scott represent are on the way out, because what you really have now is almost a replica of the Blade Runner. No,
yeah, I know it's on
a replica of the old studio system with Marvel, right? Where it's all in-house and they have their own people who do everything, and then they hire the directors to come in and work inside their universe. By the way, Villeneuve, speaking of Dune and Blade Runner, put his mouth in it today. Yeah. I want to send out a directive to all directors. Don't diss Marvel. It's not going to come back well for you. It's so interesting. I think Denis Villeneuve is a man of taste and distinction and a great, great filmmaker, and I love Dune, but that's not what you, he and Scorsese, he should have learned.
Well, you should reiterate. So what did Villeneuve say?
He basically said that the Marvel movies are cookie cutter formulas, you know, copies of each other, which I totally disagree with. It isn't true. If you've seen them all, which I highly doubt he has.
Probably hasn't. I mean, it's more about the concept. I mean, Scorsese hadn't either, but I also think, you know, I was watching Shang-Chi last week and I enjoyed a lot of it, but I also think that there is this question of, you know, there are broader existential questions about cinema versus product that people who are really, you know, artist first types and don't want to play the industry game wrestle with. And when you get asked about these things, you can't always necessarily say exactly.
I recognize what you're saying. I guess I would say to someone like Scorsese or Villeneuve, consider the language you're using and how you use your words. Because of course, what you're saying is true. I decry it as much as anyone else. The studios are responsible for not giving room to all the other movies that are out there, all the different ranges and the diversity you're talking about. And by the way, Antoine Fuqua might be one of the most commercial African-American directors out there.
Yeah,
who else is there?
It's a fascinating
Spike
question.
Spike Lee doesn't necessarily generate income. He's more of a specialty guy. He would say he's a studio man, and he is, but I would say that the budgets are at a certain... He would say he hasn't gotten the budgets he wanted all the time for the movies he wanted to do.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully Barry Jenkins is on his way with his Disney project, but I mean, Fuqua
Ryan Coogler. Ryan Coogler.
And Coogler has figured out a way. I mean, we'll see. I mean, obviously Black Panther is coming, but you know, he's sort of
that's
on the
Marvel,
rise.
But that's Marvel. So outside of Marvel, would they Fuqua. Give him that budget? Would you say?
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting question. I mean, Coogler, he's a very active producer, and he produced Space Jam 2, which wasn't necessarily
he did really well with the Creed movie. That was
exactly.
A very commercial, very down the middle kind of.
Yeah. Would love
and
to see
edgy,
is Coogler,
a good movie.
It could Coogler sort of wrestle his way into a deal the way that say Christopher Nolan could.
There are a lot of directors who have promise too, who given the right resources could move forward, like Ronaldo Marcus Green, the guy who did King Richard.
Yes.
The world is his oyster right now.
Yes, exactly. And that's a really good point, because you also have Will Smith, who has a production company, which is you know, the entity that hired him. So in some ways you also see like sort of a separate pipeline for more diverse talent. So that's that business side of the industry is going to keep evolving in really interesting ways. Well, I wanted to talk about another filmmaker who has a very unique deal with Warner Brothers and is still there, because he has a movie opening this week.
Clint!
At age 91, Clint Eastwood is without question. I haven't done my research. I just know it to be true.
I don't think we can argue with this.
The only guy at this age to ever be directing studio movies and also acting in them. And even just directing them. I don't think it's ever happened. I mean, it's just the weirdest thing. I loved seeing Manuel Oliveira make three movies past the age of 100 that were also really challenging and fascinating.
Art films.
And some of the new wave folks made it into their 90s. Godard passed 90 this past year. But I mean, I watched Cry Macho. It's not bad. I really liked it.
It's like putting on an old comfortable sweater because you know him so well. I happen to love Clint Eastwood. I do. I don't have to agree with his politics, etc., but I love the guy. I've loved him for decades. I've interviewed him many times, and he's an unusual anomaly, you know? He's a movie star, he's a producer, he's a director, he's in control of his fate, he has a relationship with the studio that is handshake, where he just tends to work at Warner Brothers. He has a whole crew of people who work with him on all the different films. He knows what he's doing, he knows what stories are going to work for him. He held on to this one for what, 30 years or something? Mm-hmm. And finally, because he didn't think he was old enough, he finally did it. Yeah.
Yeah, what I find fascinating about these late period Eastwood films is that when he acts in them, tonally, they're very different because he's so cognizant of his screen presence, but also just he plays certain types and he's in his older age become constantly the person who plays the sort of aging masculine archetype in, you know, a world that maybe
You carry the old archetype with you in your head. That's why it works. Yeah. So if he tips his hat a certain way,
yeah,
or you
there.
Look into his eyes a certain way, or he makes a certain smirk, you remember it from another
movie.
It's
very meta. Yeah, it's very meta. It's almost like a Charlie Kaufman-esque type of a gamble. And like he does, but it's not explicit either. It's not like he's just thinking about it in those terms. So it's very weird. And
it's almost like he has the language down to some kind of haiku. You know, it's very simple, really. Go ahead.
He's fun to watch. No, I was just going to say, I mean, and I found this on The Mule as well, was like, there's something about how good he is that really doesn't help everybody else in the frame with him. Like, so in this movie, he's this sort of faded cowboy who's asked by his former employer to go rescue the guy's son to bring him back from Mexico.
So he's a man on a mission.
So he's a man on a mission, and which is a fascinating sort of
old trope, old
guy,
Western
right?
trope.
Yeah. You've seen a version of this movie before, and then it becomes kind of like a buddy movie where he's bringing the kid, who he calls kid all the time in old school movie parlance, and they sort of bond. He brings him back across the border.
And
while
the kid has the cock.
Yeah, let's be clear, a rooster actually named Macho, which is very entertaining. I just felt like that the actor who played that kid, the actor who played his mother, the actress who plays the kind of potential love interest they meet along the way, they're okay. But they didn't stand out to me. And I wonder if it's just because there's some part of the process where they don't try that hard in the casting because they have Clint, or maybe it's because he moves so fast that he doesn't, you know, he's obviously not like Kubrickian. He doesn't do a bunch of takes. And
God, no.
Right.
You're lucky if you get one or two out of him.
And you can feel
it. He's famous for that. That's been true for a long time. He doesn't labor over any of it. And you got to get it right away. And
but
I would
sometimes
say
they don't.
Very few people stand up to him in most of his films.
Yeah. I mean, who's going to? Who's going to say, Clint, maybe we should do another take because he sounded
Was legendarily, he fought with Kevin Costner on Perfect World. Kevin wasn't liking it at all. Meryl went for it. There was always a rumor that he and Meryl had an affair on the set.
No, it's a rumor between the stars.
Of Bridges of Madison County, which is my favorite. Here's another thing about Clint. He's willing to wear his heart on his sleeve. He's willing to be emotional and sensitive as a lover, as a man in movies, which is not necessarily de rigueur these days.
Yeah, I mean, there is certainly a corniness at play in Cry Macho that you kind of have to just roll with. But it's also, you know, I read the ending very literally, in a very literal way, and I won't spoil it. But I did feel like there's a way to look at it almost as dreamlike in the sense that, you know, this is a guy who has been riding off into the sunset for like 20, 30 years, something like that, since Unforgiven. And every time it's like a little bit more pronounced. And this time it felt like really like a specific sort of, you know, this is my ideal, is just to like fade into the happiness of being this character I've played year after year after year. And I think that's what makes Cry Macho actually a really appealing movie to several generations of people. It's just to see Clint being in that state, to continue to be that person.
He's being a parent, he's being a father, and he's being a partner and a lover. And he's sort of telling us this is more important than being macho.
Right. That if I can leave you with one thing, it's don't be it's, the way.
Don't buy into that old was. That old stuff.
Yeah, you know?
But he was telling us that back with Unforgiven too.
Yeah, because he was already kind
he
of
he was already deconstructing the masculinity that he embodied.
But here's what I'm wondering. So obviously, there's a fundamental appeal to Clint that crosses generations. My father will want to watch this movie, and I know he told Kenny Turan in the L.A. Times, you know, how the hell is all that going to work out with the day and date release that Warner Brothers is
doing? So are the older audiences going to show up for him? I bet a lot of the males do. I bet a lot of those guys, the sort of between the coast guys who love him, do show up.
Are you saying
a lot of people?
Or?
Yeah. But I think most people are going to watch it HBO Max.
Well, I actually think the Clint brand translates very nicely into a streaming context.
This is also not a super visual thing anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
it'll look fine on a home TV. Yeah.
It's pretty, but it's not necessarily a large canvas movie. I mean, it almost makes me wonder, like, could Clint heading into his mid-90s just continue to make movies in today's climate, because his iconography and his sensibility both actually translate very well to the climate for home viewing right now. I mean, Cry Macho would be, I think, a harder movie to get a lot of audiences to go see. And 2 or 3 years ago, we'd be like, well, whatever. It's just, you know, those movies aren't super expensive for a studio to produce. They can take a loss because they still have Clint. Now it's almost like he fits pretty nicely into the HBO Max paradigm. So,
well, let's see how many more movies he has in him. I mean, this could be his last one. It would be fine if it was.
Yeah, he looks a little frail, but he also
he does. I worry about him falling over. He gets on a horse and he throws a weird punch. I grant you.
I mean, look, making a movie is hard business. Like, you have to be on a set, coordinating with other people. Even if he moves fast, he was still doing something fairly difficult in multiple ways there, which is just fascinating to see from so many on so many levels. But anyway, let's talk about Toronto. So because in spite of all these other things going on, the film festival scene has continued, and you know, we dug deep on Telluride. We had a great time there, and we're sorry that we can't be on the ground in Toronto this year, but we've been doing our best to compensate by watching films.
Absolutely.
And tracking the buzz.
I've been watching every day.
So what is your sense of what's actually resonating? First off, let's look at the bigger films, because there are some bigger films that definitely have sort of benefited from the additional bump of TIFF buzz.
Well, there's Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho, which I loved. I just loved this movie. It's a genre mash, 60s style, incredible performances by Thomasin McKenzie and Anya Taylor-Joy, and not to underestimate the late, great Eleanor, I want to say Diana Rigg. I was going to say Eleanor Rigby. Do you believe it? Diana Rigg is fantastic. And Edgar Wright just uses his, you know, characteristic flair to full effect. It's kind of a scary movie. Is it a horror movie, Eric?
Well, I have, as we are recording, I haven't seen it yet. So I'll report back next week on that one. But I always have appreciated that Wright's films defy those kinds of boundaries, and that's usually the best way to go. So I'm looking forward. The reactions to it have really been intriguing to me, from Venice and now Toronto. So it seems like Focus has a nice potential commercial play in terms of just the level of anticipation that's been coming out.
I'm also curious to see how Eyes of Tammy Faye ends up going over. I mean, I'm confident that Jessica Chastain delivers a Best Actress performance in the title role, and Andrew Garfield is great, but I suspect that Tick, Tick, Boom will be his big Oscar play. So this is a Searchlight movie. They're pulling out all the stops. It's an entertaining movie, first and foremost. most because about these two televangelists. It's almost a comedic performance. It's a fascinating range of things that she's doing there.
I thought she's playing this, you know, American evangelist who, you know, is just such an eccentric character. There was a documentary made about her a little over 20 years ago. And to me, it was like, it's not quite satire, but it's sort of like a wink, wink at the audience. Like, I'm not really making fun of her, but it's okay to kind of laugh at who she is because of just, you know, it's such a transformation for Chastain. She's by far the only thing I think that really works about that movie. Garfield,
well, because
I think
you care about her. Yeah, he's the villain, in effect.
The villain, but also they age him up in a way that didn't really work for me. It seemed kind of hokey. There was just, it's just a little all over the place.
I actually think Michael Showalter did a good job. I think this is based on that documentary, this is a very, very difficult movie to pull off. And I thought they did a good job.
Well, I guess what I got out of it is that it is a engaging narrative way to kind of explain how evangelical Christianity managed to be so powerful in this country. You see how that the realization that getting into people's TV sets rather than just calling TV the Antichrist was a brilliant maneuver in a way. And there are some creepy things about that and so forth. I don't know if it fully clarifies all of that to the extent that I would have liked. And I wasn't super invested in the emotional trajectory of these two characters throughout a very long movie. But again, it's Chastain all the way. I mean, I guess
absolutely.
The question is, does a movie like this, I mean, now we know what it is. TIFF decided to give her this acting award. Does this become the kind of movie where even if not everybody is 100% on board with the film as a whole, the performance is just so strong, it just carries her all the way to the award show?
Absolutely. Biopics tend to do well. I mean, Renee Zellweger would be one example in Judy.
That movie was worse, by the way.
Much worse. So yeah, exactly. I'm using that as an example of, you know, it doesn't, I would say that, you know, whatever you think of Respect, Jennifer Hudson's got a shot here too. You know, it'll probably happen. Of course, Toronto continued to promote other things, including Dear Evan Hansen, which got a lot of negative reviews.
It
is sitting at 42 on Metacritic, which is not a very good place to be for an Oscar contender. Although I would say if there's any group that appreciates the craft that was required to pull off this high wire act of turning a stage musical like this into a movie, it is the Academy. And it played okay at the DGA where I saw it with some applause. I would say this is probably not a contender.
The movie that I think actually really benefited from TIFF buzz, and the next few days should tell that story more, I would expect, is Belfast, which if I had to put my money down and say there's an obvious contender for the People's Choice Award, it would be that one.
I would say.
Yeah, but Belfast seems to be the one that has really been the big crowd pleaser out of TIFF, as far as I could tell. I mean,
oh, by the way, Eric, out of Telluride, there was a poll that this guy Michael Patterson does every year with a bunch of critics, and I was shocked that your favorite movie was the top ranked choice above Power
more.
Of the Dog.
Tell
Marcel.
Me more.
Marcel.
Well, Marcel the Shell was a unique Telluride experience, right? When you think about it, Power of the Dog was a movie that started at Venice. Marcel the Shell was the surprise movie. And by the way, still does not have distribution, though. I've heard that there have been some pitches going on, and I'm sure they're taking their time with that one. It's nice that we're having that. I mean, I'll say with TIFF, I've tried to explore the program the same way that I would have any other year and find films that go beyond kind of the obvious. That aren't necessarily...
Any discoveries?
Yeah, I've had some discoveries. There was a film that I really, really enjoyed and had absolutely no visibility except that it was available for me to watch on the digital platform. And that was called Doug Doug, spelled, it looks like Doug Doug in English. It's a first-time filmmaker from India named Ritwik Parikh. And it's basically about this motorcycle accident happens, and the place where the motorcycle crashes, everyone thinks that the motorcycle has like special powers, and they start building shrines around it, and then it becomes a temple, and then it becomes a religion, and it becomes this fascinating metaphor for these kinds of, you know, like remote temples that you see in places like India and how sort of, you know, the origin story of something can lead to myth. And so it's a great sort of satire. I thought a better satire of religion than Tammy Faye, but also it's like very entertaining, very, very strange. Kind of reminded me of Quentin Dupieux's films, the guy who made Rubber and Steak and all that. And also just like a great first time filmmaker discovery kind of a thing. So I'm always looking for those kinds of things. Lucille has Halilovic's film, Earwigs, a very cool sort of like Buñuel-esque twist on Hammer Horror that I really enjoyed as well. So there's stuff happening on the TIFF front.
I really enjoyed I'm Your Man, which is Maria Schrader's German Oscar entry. And oddly enough, it stars Dan Stevens as a humanoid robot who's programmed to be a lover, to be a companion, to be a partner. And the woman, the academic who's assigned to evaluate him and live with him for 3 weeks is resistant initially, of course. And it goes where it goes. It's really, he has to speak fluent German with a British accent.
Yeah, I saw this film out of the virtual Berlin earlier this year because it was in competition there. And I appreciated it. I thought it had some clunkier moments, especially in the midsection, but I liked where it ended. It's, yeah. We've seen stories about sort of the human robot love situation.
It's like Her a bit. Yeah,
it does. It's more wistful than you might expect at first, I suppose. But
well, okay. We're not ideal partners, we humans.
That's an understatement. So,
what else did I see? I saw the. I caught up with the Terrence Davies movie, which what's it called? Benediction. Mm-hmm. And that was a little strange, a little odd, a little brilliant. You know, the way he always is.
You know, one
gay love story.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I would love to see that.
Set in World War II aftermath.
The one that seems like it's really continuing to gather momentum outside of Belfast is The Rescue, which everybody I've spoken to is just like over the moon about. I mean, I'm impressed by just how well this movie is.
It plays well. You know why? Because it's about competence. It's about people who mean well, who get together and pull together, and they're ingenious and they figure out solutions and they win. And so, you know, here we are fighting against COVID and not necessarily winning that battle the way we would like. All the different reasons that our world is full of incompetence and people who don't do the right thing. And when you get it, you welcome it and you embrace it. I think Fauci is similar in a way. You embrace his do-gooderness in that documentary.
But Fauci didn't go into a cave.
No, he didn't go into a cave, but he's also heroic.
And then have to anesthetize a bunch of kids. I mean, the story behind this thing, and it's going to be fun to watch people continue to talk about it. I mean, they're lucky that they were the first out of the gate with this one, because we know there are some other stories coming, like the Ron Howard adaptation and a Netflix series. So by the time those come around, this will sort of set the foundation. It seems to have set the right tone. So good news for that one in the weeks ahead. And, you know, we know there's some other Nat Geo stuff on the horizon, like Matt Heineman's new documentary about COVID, which is going to open
First the Wave.
Yeah, opening the Hamptons Film Festival. So that company's going to have a good season, it seems like. So next week, where are we going to be at? I think you're coming to town.
New York.
You're coming to my hood.
I'm going to be flying, actually, on the day that we usually do the podcast. So we might
have to figure out
rejigger that. But I'll be in your hood, and I'm looking forward to opening night, the Tragedy of Macbeth, at the Joel Coen solo outing with wife Frances McDormand and Denzel playing the ultimate power couple.
You couldn't ask for a more upbeat way to bring back New York's greatest film festival at Tully Hall than Macbeth, a true life affirming story.
The Scottish play.
I mean, I can't wait to see the movie. I think it's going to be awesome. Obviously, Joel and Frances are a real New York power couple, so that'll be a nice pairing to have in person. And I can't wait to to boogie with you at Tavern on the Green. It'll be fun to be around.
I love it. Of all the years I grew up in New York, I always looked forward to
film prom.
Fall, crisp air, New York Film Festival. It was like the high point of my year.
I'll see you soon, Ed.
Glad to be back.
Travels.
Okay, bye-bye.